broadens the definition of domestic terrorist that could be used to censor protests of dissent. Joining Heather to discuss the implications of this proposed bill will be civil rights lawyer and 2020 candidate for the 10th District, Michael Siegel. And at 11, it's Between the Covers. David Naiman welcomes Brandon Shimoda, an American of Japanese descent. He talks about his family being an enemy of the state during World War II in his book, The Grave on the Wall. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of PDX Short Docs on Sunday, September 1st at 6 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater.
Press the button to begin.
PDX Short Docs is a two-hour program of Portland-related short documentaries by local filmmakers. The first hour features several 360-degree short documentaries on virtual reality headsets. The main screening starts at 7. Featuring the films Green Box, Palo Mesa, Speaking Out, and more. Again, that's the PDX Short Docs on Sunday, September 1st at 6 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Development Committee will meet the first Wednesday of each month at 4:30 p.m.
The Heather McCoy Show.
And welcome to the Heather McCoy Show. Against domestic political backdrop of increasing incidents of racially motivated violence, mass shootings, and fascist marches, one Texas Congressman, Representative Michael McCaul, is proposing a new bill which would broaden the definition of, quote, domestic terrorists that can be used to censor protests of dissent. Joining us to discuss the implications of this proposed bill is civil rights lawyer and 2020 candidate for the 10th District in Texas, House of Representatives federally, is Michael Siegel. He wrote an article entitled Dissent is Being Criminalized Under Our Noses. It can be found at truthdig.com. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you, Heather. Great to be here.
Good to be here, too. And, yeah, I chose a smaller font than I'm used to. In 2001, we've seen a government crackdown on dissent from George W. Bush stating, quote, either you're with us or for the terrorists in the aftermath of 9/11, or the Obama administration attempting to silence whistleblowers, culminating with both Chelsea Manning and the Justice Department trying to go after journalist James Risen's sources. What makes this House bill, which I should note hasn't been signed a House resolution number yet, different?
I think it's in the same vein. And it might be useful to use Naomi Klein's terminology of the shock doctrine. You know, responding to a crisis and using the cover of responding to the crisis to implement draconian legislation that folks have been preparing for years, but this gives them cover to do that. And so just like the Patriot Act was used ostensibly to respond to Al-Qaeda and international terrorism, and instead ended up resulting in librarians having to report on what books we checked out and Muslims being profiled across the country. Now we have this crisis of white supremacist mass shootings in the United States, And unfortunately, Congressman McCall, in concert with Henry Cuellar and another Texas congressperson, they're using this as an opportunity to criminalize dissent, and in particular, to go after folks who commit property damage during a political protest, which seems to be the precision target of this bill.
As you noted in your op-ed, the five crimes which compose the bill's definition of, quote, domestic terrorism are murder, kidnapping, aggravated assault, simple assault, and property damage. All our crimes are under existing law, but this, as you were stating, this bill does include property damage and even attempted property damage under as a terrorist act with a 25-year minimum sentence that's mandatory. This reeks as an attempt to recreate the Rockefeller drugs laws that were enacted in the state of New York under Nelson Rockefeller and federalize it for acts of protest. Does Representative McCall take money from companies like Geo Group, which have an interest in creating an increased prison population?
He does, and sadly, we have a private immigration jail north of Austin, controlled by what used to be called Corrections Corp of America, now Civic Corp, and McCall has taken money from them, while at the same time, he used to be chairman of Homeland Security, and he would advocate to increase the number of beds that would be filled in these immigration detention centers. He also takes money from fossil fuel industries, and I think that has to be zeroed in on as a key driver of this legislation. Ever since the Standing Rock protests, and I actually attended those protests in North and South Dakota, the pipeline companies and the oil and gas industry have been thinking of ways to criminalize any effort to basically block pipeline construction or raise attention to issues of tribal sovereignty and how we shouldn't be building these pipelines. And so there is model draft legislation from the fossil fuel industry that mirrors some parts of this McCall bill, in particular creating massive federal sentences for property damage. And this bill would punish up to 25 years in federal prison for a property damage or attempted property damage in the course of a political protest. And that's exactly what the pipeline folks want.
As you write in your piece as well, you say that you're a civil rights lawyer. You're trained to look for vague language. What's the vaguest amount of language what's the vague language in this bill that can make it so that the government can interpret it a wide variety of ways?
Well, the key is how they define what would be terroristic intent.
Okay.
And so you can commit any sort of crime. I mean, obviously, murder in this country is punishable by life in prison or even, unfortunately, the death penalty under state and federal law. But so that would be an intent to, you know, commit a murder. But here they say any of these crimes, like you enumerated those five crimes, if they are committed with the intent to coerce the populace or influence or affect government policy. So imagine how broad that is. Any action intended to influence government policy. And that's where, you know, I came up with this list in the article. Well, I mean, if you're at a Standing Rock protest and someone puts some glue in the bulldozer to prevent it from operating, and we're drawing attention to how, you know, global warming and how we shouldn't be building this pipeline on sovereign land, that would be under the definition of terrorist intent. If you're at a Black Lives Matter protest and someone spray paints on the freeway Black Lives Matter, that's property damage designed to influence police policy. And you could go on, even the Boston Tea Party, right? Dumping tea in the harbor to influence perception about, you know, English rule. That's terroristic intent under this law. And so it's extremely broad. And it has nothing to do with white supremacy, these hateful attacks in places like El Paso in Texas, which have a much different intent. And those are hate crimes. And those are punishable under federal hate crimes law. And so McCall and Cuellar are pretending to respond to a current crisis, but really they're trying to slip in something that pleases their corporate benefactors.
This seems like an implementation measure that the Trump administration was really brutal with the people that were trying to charge them pretty stiffly for protesting the inauguration in 2016. This seems like an implementation measure so that Trump can crack down on dissent even further.
Certainly. I mean, as a civil rights lawyer, I represented protesters in the Occupy movement, for example.
Sure.
And, this would just give almost unfettered discretion to a federal prosecutor to charge all sorts of crimes and to sweep in people who are not even the direct perpetrator. You know, I was at protests where people threw rocks at bank windows. I mean, that would be a crime under this law, a terrorist crime, punishable by 25 years. And anyone who is deemed to be an accomplice or part of a quote-unquote conspiracy or an attempt, I mean, all those people will be swept into this law. Now, as you noted, Heather, this is not yet even a filed bill. It's been, you know, published online by the three congresspeople supporting it. Hopefully, Nancy Pelosi will never let it see the light of day. But one thing that concerned me is that already it's being promoted as a bipartisan bill. And that's because Henry Cuellar is a Democrat on the Texas border. He's actually being challenged by a progressive in his primary this year. But he, unfortunately, in many instances, acts the same way as Republican members of Congress.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
So because it has that bipartisan sheen, I'm concerned it might get a little bit of traction.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, like, what's the chances of it passing since the Democrats do control the House, but it doesn't sound like it's slim unless the bipartisanship thing makes Chuck Todd go gushy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You wrote that the bill includes the word convoyance in the definition of property damage. What is the legal meaning of that word? I've not been to law school. And how would it specifically apply to the Standing Rock protests?
Right. So, I mean, it singles out types of property damage. And the big picture concept is that most crimes are supposed to be prosecuted by the states, you know, in our federalist government. So state law for vandalism should cover, you know, damage to a building or something. But you can bring in federal law if you establish that it involves interstate issues, like more than one state. And so a conveyance, that's an accepted term for things like a highway, a telephone, you know, wire, electrical network, and also a pipeline. And that's the key word that as soon as I read that, I was like, okay, this is about Standing Rock, because, you know, a pipeline conveys oil across interstate boundaries. And so that's what allows federal prosecutors to be brought into this. And as we see, you know, President Trump determined, you know, he believes that anyone who's against his policies is an enemy of the state, basically. And so given that he's tweeting about Antifa and these protests in Portland, for example, it does seem, you know, very interesting, the timing that McCall is surfacing this bill at the same time the president is on the warpath against basically protesters who are against fascism.
Yeah, I was going to point that out. That's the backdrop that it occurs. Patriot prayer leader Joey Gibson is from Vancouver, Washington. Isn't there already statutes against crossing state lines to basically start a riot? If so, the Patriot prayer has basically admitted at this point their purpose to coming to Portland is to start fights for use for propaganda video purposes online. Why doesn't Trump's Justice Department go after Joey Gibson?
Right. No, I assume that's a rhetorical question, but yeah, uh-huh. That's who they should be focusing on. And unfortunately, ever since Trump and when he had Sessions as his attorney general, as soon as they got in power, they de-emphasized investigations of white supremacists and white hate groups. They you know, reduced some federal programs to break up those groups, and unfortunately, they seem to be on the same trajectory now.
Yeah, and in the press release that announced the Domestic Terrorism Penalties Act of 2019, Representative McCall brings up Dayton and the El Paso shootings, and this bill offers a way to combat domestic terrorism. This bill lacks any gun control measures which would make those attacks possible. If elected, what would you do to combat acts of domestic terrorism by white supremacists?
That's fair, yes. So first of all, I would support legislation to increase the Department of Justice and Attorney General's programs to investigate these groups, break them up. Some people don't realize this, but the foundation of our federal civil rights law, if you've ever filed a federal civil rights lawsuit, it dates back to what was called the Ku Klux Klan Act, and this is passed right after the Civil War. So really, we need to return that focus of our federal law to breaking up these hate groups, which are a huge threat to our democracy. And that's on the enforcement side. In terms of regulating guns, you know, I support all the so-called common sense gun control measures, whether it's red flag laws, comprehensive background checks, getting rid of the loopholes for sales at gun shows and the like. And also eliminating these weapons of war on our streets, these, you know, automatic assault rifles that are really only useful to kill large amounts of people in a small amount of time and aren't appropriate for civilian use.
Yeah. Shifting towards your electoral race against Representative McCaul in the 10th District of Texas, part of the framework in the War on Terror, the Bush administration coined the term, quote, enemy combatant and held those prisoners indefinitely in Guantanamo Bay. Many are still there. The Trump administration has clearly opened up concentration camps for migrants. Some of them are located in Texas. If you're elected, do you have a plan to unwind both of these crimes against humanity?
Yes. Well, you know, in terms of Guantanamo, I think we need to, put that in the forefront as a major priority to get rid of these, to end the indefinite detention of folks. I know it's complicated by some of these folks being stateless to some extent, that they don't have home countries to be returned to, but that needs to be a major priority, because if the United States is going to have any credibility in terms of international diplomacy, we can't have, you know, massive human rights violations occurring under our own jurisdiction. And so I definitely would like to close Guantanamo and would support every effort to do that. In terms of the family separation crisis, that's a huge issue here in Texas. The congressional district I'm running in, the Texas 10th, runs from Austin to Houston and includes a lot of activists who are very committed to this fight to close the camps for these kids and families who are seeking asylum. Unfortunately, the incumbent, Michael McCaul, is firmly committed to that policy. He was chairman of Homeland Security while family separation was happening. And even though once in a while he would say something like, I'm not comfortable with what's happening, he never opened a hearing. He never started an investigation. He could have stopped that policy. And I have to give credit to Julian Castro in his presidential campaign for drawing attention to the legal underpinning of family separation, which is this law in the immigration code that basically criminalizes border crossing. I mean, historically, it was a civil offense if you crossed the border without having a proper visa or permit. And then in the early 20th century, some segregationist neo-Confederate types turned it into a federal crime. And that criminal statute is what enables the separation of mothers and fathers from their children. Because just like if you go to county jail, you can't bring your kids with you. Once you're incarcerated on a criminal offense, you can't have your kids with you. And, you know, some people say we just need to adjust the policy, you know, in terms of how that law is implemented. But really, you need to take away the underpinning, because if we repeal that law, I believe it's Section 1350, we then take away the opportunity for folks like Trump to prosecute migrants in this way.
I was going to say, Castro, during debates, has been impressive on this issue as somebody that's worked with ICE detainees under the Obama administration, which was no cakewalk either. How do you prepare to deal with some of your colleagues that might not feel the same way about this issue as you do?
Sure. So it was Section 1325.
Oh, okay.
You know, I think big picture, everyone's on board with the moral argument that family separation is wrong. But some Democrats are scared of the optics, so to speak, of being accused of being open borders. And this is one of these opportunities where I think we need to move away from the poll-driven politics and do what's right and commit ourselves to educating the American people about why it's important this law needs to be repealed. Because most people don't know what Section 1325 is. They say family separation's wrong, but maybe we shouldn't have open borders. And so I think with those guideposts, we can educate people, well, yes, we're not going to have open borders. There's still ways to deport people who shouldn't be in the country, even under civil law, which is how it used to be. That's how it was done for the first 150 years in this country. But we don't need to have laws that enable, you know, would-be dictators like Trump to commit these human rights abuses. And so I think we have to be a little bit courageous in having conversations that are uncomfortable and that might not be easily distilled into a quick soundbite, but are essential to preserving our integrity as a democracy.
One of the things I noticed when I was looking up your district, the Texas map is drawn in perfect squares in the more rural areas, and then it gets a little bit misshapen, and we're used to seeing the congressional districts that are gerrymandered. How badly is it gerrymandering in Texas, and how are you preparing your campaign to overcome that?
Oh, it's terribly gerrymandered. Basically, 2003, Karl Rove and Tom DeLay came to Texas and redrew the map, and, you know, with just the stroke of a pen, dramatically changed the number of Republican representatives. I think it went from a bare majority to a two-thirds majority just by changing the lines. So the Texas 10th is no different. It used to be a hill country district, which means, for those of you that don't know Texas, basically from Austin to the west, it was a district represented by Lyndon B. Johnson, among other historic Democrats. But then it was redrawn to basically go from Austin east across seven rural counties into these heavy Republican Houston suburbs, and suddenly became a 60% Republican district. Now, because of that, McCall was basically virtually unchallenged for his first 12 years in office. So last cycle, when I started campaigning, I was the nominee in this district in 2018. McCall had a 19% advantage. But by running a real campaign, progressive, grassroots, you know, 1,000 volunteers, knocking on doors in every county, we got his advantage down to 4% in one cycle, and, you know, ramping up to do it again in 2020. And so, you know, the work that Beto O'Rourke did, running statewide, going to every county, and a lot of candidates down ballot like myself, we are creating the conditions for lasting progressive change in Texas. What we like to say is that Texas is not a red state, it's a non-voting state.
Yeah.
And we need to show up everywhere and let folks know that the Democratic Party is real, that we're going to fight for them, that we're not scared of these attacks, you know, that they like to call us socialists because we support health care, you know, they like to call us open borders because we want a humane border policy. But we got to, you know, stand up and fight back and not be scared of these folks.
I was going to ask you, you name dropped Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein. You mentioned that it doesn't seem like you like the death penalty either. The Intercept had an article they published a while back. It was a tape recording of Standy Hoyer talking to a Colorado representative in a Democratic primary. He was the more progressive of the two, and the DCCC said basically, "We're not supporting you. We don't think you can win." And he's like, "Can you give me a shot? Can you not like put your thumbs on the scale?" And then Standy Hoyer kind of laughed at him. Do you have issues with the DCCC yourself, or is it going pretty well?
No, I mean, they're not very friendly. Actually, I went on the Young Turks last week and kind of talked to Cenk about this. You know, they're not explicitly against me, but because I don't have the big money donors, and because I you know, have progressive policies, you know, supporting Medicare for all that the leadership doesn't necessarily support, they are actively looking for other folks. And it seems like right now, for example, even though I'm the one that kind of helped put this district in play for 2020, there's rumblings that they're going to support basically a former Republican corporate defense lawyer, a woman who's going to run against me in the primary. So even though I've got the support of all these precinct chairs and unions and grassroots groups, I think they see in me as someone that they can't control and is not part of their agenda, and so they're looking for other people to back.
Yeah. Since Beto O'Rourke almost won the U.S. Senate against his Texas's favorite son, Ted Cruz, in 2018, do you think Beto's going to come back after his presidential campaign is over and run for Senate again, or what do you think his big plan is?
Unfortunately, it doesn't seem like that. But it doesn't seem like that's going to be a possible outcome here. So, by the way, Heather, unfortunately, I have to get off in a minute.
But, yeah.
The big picture, it doesn't seem like Beto's coming back, but we have a lot of progressives who are going to run similar style campaigns in 2020. And especially if we get the right nominee at the presidential level, I think we can continue to advance the cause in Texas.
Thanks for joining us. The article, once again, is on truthdig.com. Dissent is being criminalized right under our noses. He's a candidate for the Texas's 10th district, Michael Sigel. Thanks for being on the Heather McCoy Show this morning.
Thank you, Heather. And just for your listeners, it's Mike Sigel.
Mike Sigel. I'm sorry.
And you can find me at siegelfortexas.org or siegelfortexas on Twitter.
Okay. Thanks for joining us. And this is the Heather McCoy Show. We'll be right back.
Heather McCoy Show.
And welcome back to the Heather McCoy Show. I was at work in the past week, and there was a customer, and I asked him if he needed any help, and he said, no, he's just wasting time. And then he proceeds me to ask me very personal questions. And if you've heard the show before, like, I'm a very open person, and I'm naturally curious. So I let him proceed, and I gave him really honest answers. His questions led to the point to ask me to know if Jesus Christ was my personal Lord and Savior. And in my head, I'm thinking, like, expletive, here we go again. It was a slow day in the store, and so I intensely listened to his pitch, but then I told him firmly that I'm evangelical and I'm not coming back. And he did all the hallmarks. He doubted that my walk was real. He maligned other religions. I did bring Buddhism into the conversation. And he downplayed the toxic culture around authoritarian Christianity. Nobody at the store knew I was in trouble, and I felt really, like, just awful for the rest of my shift. Like, I know I'm trans, and I know it, but at the store I work at, I do not pass. But it's so tiring that people just don't know boundaries at all. And it seems like it's becoming more and more of a thing where if someone talks to you at all, if they can at least, like, get their face from out of their phone, this is the kind of stuff that happens. And it's not very good. I don't know, like... I completely understand that the term civility is a weapon that's used against the powerless for the powerful. And so when, like, you have Republican senators going on Meet the Press and they're like, I don't think they're very civil, that's just them not liking the fact that you're effectively calling out their horse hockey. And so, but at the same time, there is a civil way to discuss things. And then this feels like it's getting really, really lost. It's like we've all become our own versions of Mr. Tangerine Man. And, you know, we're all our big wet president, and we're just a Twitter feed in person from a shouting match. And it's not a good thing. So, like, this man, he asked me if everlasting life, he talked about everlasting life as it was, like, a good thing. I don't understand this concept. Like, I understand the being afraid to die. I have very vivid dreams of, I have these really odd vivid dreams of, like, being chased down by the mafia, and then like I'm running away from gunfire, and I've never been in a mass shooting. I don't know where these dreams come from, but they are there, and I am trying to save myself. So I do have an instinct survival mechanism at play, but I've never figured out why someone would want their life to be everlasting, and ever having everlasting consciousness. And you're like, oh, if you accept God, now you're at peace. And then like I my vision is like, I've lived enough trauma and sadness and memories. I just want to rest from myself and my environment, and then when my time on earth is up. And I'm not really sure, I don't know when people can I don't know. I know evangelicals don't have boundaries, and that's one of the hallmarks of evangelicalism. But at the same time, it seems like the wider there's wider people at play that are having this problem too, and you can discuss things and have ideas and not shout each other down. And I don't understand why people feel so like personally attacked at literally all times. I don't get it. I don't think I ever will get it. But at the same time, like, we're in a really bad hole, folks, and it's like we need to like band together and figure out how to move forward in every realm of life, and not just like, oh, I see a trans person, so I think I'm gonna just, you know, tell them about God for the upteenth time. And that's a funny thing, right? Is like, we have a super Christian culture, and then like these people go around thinking like, oh yeah, this person, they've probably never heard of Jesus Christ before. I bet I'm the first one to tell them. And it's just really, 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 really bizarre. So we're gonna be right back. We're going to take your calls, do some news. This has been a really kind of last-minute put-together show, but we'll figure something out. This is the Heather McCoy Show.
At the onset, those of you who may have heard me should probably turn to those who may have not and calmly reassure them that this is, in fact, what happens when I sit on a stage. Not much more. This is about it. You'll notice no sudden or dramatic change in either my instrumental or vocal attack, as it were. This is nonetheless an American folk song. Did you recognize it as such? Of course you would. You folks. You don't hear them much anymore. Don't hear them on your AM radio, huh? Folk singers hardly ever sing them. That's because they're boring. Folk music is boring. Whack, fall the dido, blowy winds, hi-ho, hell, that's boring. But I am a folk singer. This is a folk music organization. You are ostensibly the folk, n'est-ce pas? That means we own this song together, right? We have thereby incurred certain social obligations which we will faithfully discharge, right? We're gonna sing this damn song together, boring or not. I'm still in Nevada City, California, up there in the foothills of the Sierra. All in the foothills, but it's spelled like that. Oh, the old gold mining town. I've talked to some of you about that. 2,700 people there, one of the 49ers towns. And I also told you about the only social life in town being the Books of Harmony New Age bookstore, where people go down in the evening and channel dolphins and Martians. It's a new age chronos and clastic infundibulum, or epicenter, as it were, Nevada City, California. Well, I was gone for a bit on one of the trips since I saw you last, and I got back, and my wife had bought the bookstore. So I am now ostensibly part proprietor of a new age bookstore in Nevada City, California. Can you picture that? Well, and I'm open to all those things. If you live in California, you've got to be open. If you're not, they pry you open. read as much as I can. She's got all the new men's literature in there. Most of my men friends belong to men's Robert Blythe men's drumming circles. We do that here. Healthy. They're out in the wilderness, caterwauling and flailing away at those things and dragging their scrotums through the underbrush. It's healthy, I suppose. We swing in the trees and we steal sheep. We don't have a drumming leader, we have a grooming order. Robert Blythe came by on one of his workshop trips to teach us how to drum. We ate him. Rural professionals. Nevada City, California. Out cruising the back roads in their old green carryalls with their car stereos, blaring meditation music out into the wilderness. It's a caution. Whole place lightning struck by the peripatetic ruminations of the Tibetan ruling class in exile. A lot of Buddhists around there. Nevada City, California. Meanwhile, this very minute, old Jesse McVeigh, the well digger, nobody knows how old he is, lived in that county all of his life, is sitting at the bar of the National Hotel this very minute, looking at the freaks out in the street and muttering under his breath, "No matter how new age you get, old age gonna kick your ass." Anyone know what I'm talking about? Nevada City, California. Nevada City, California. Nevada City, California.
Heather McCoy Show.
Welcome back to the Heather McCoy Show. In other news this morning, David Koch actually passed away. Also, what died last night was a Koch Brothers back major in Phoenix, which would have banned the expansion of the city's light rail system. It was Proposition 105, which was drafted by a Koch-funded nonprofit. And I think Phoenix has about like an 8 mile, I want to say off the top of my head, it's like a 7 or 8 mile light rail. They want to expand it. And they were going to try to make it so that this local city could not expand it any further. The Arizona Free Enterprise Club. Oh, that's hysterical. It's a nonprofit backed by Americans for Prosperity. And your friends and mine. And so they wanted to basically have 105 pass, and then you're going to divert money to road projects. As we say all the time when I have Aaron from No More Freeways PDX, It's you basically, when you build freeways, you're inviting more traffic. It's called induced demand. It's in a book. Read it. So that's a really good news. The city of Phoenix is often called the least sustainable city in America for obvious reasons. You're drawing off a water plain that includes the Colorado River for your city's water. Your snowpacks are diminishing in the Rockies due to global warming, and you're sharing that water with Las Vegas and Los Angeles, by the way. Or some of the water with Los Angeles. So Phoenix is actually going ahead, and it looks like they're going to extend that light rail a little bit further. Editorially, just going off the roadmap here, off the news story for a bit, come on, Portland, we can do better. Like, I understand that, like, the light rail system, the MAX, is the pride and joy of the city, and I absolutely love running it or riding it, and but, like, at the same time, there's so many different areas where it can be improved, both zoning-wise and, like, speed-wise. And that is the good news as well, is the No More Freeways PDX crew that I talk to every once in a while here on the show, the Rose City Corridor expansion proposed was put into full environmental review. So they're not going to just steamroll that project and just add a bunch more freeway capacity near the Rose Quarter. They're going to put it in full environmental review. Hopefully that will get shot down. ODOT has three different people that are vying to be the leader of ODOT, none of them with very promising prospects as far as being rail advocates. So hopefully we can build a movement to work with them to do more rail. But I think ultimately what needs to happen is you need to add capacity to rail around the Rose Quarter. That probably includes grade separation under river and under the stadium, or under the stadium by the stadium, so that you can add more capacity to run trains. It probably includes more capacity as well at Gateway Plaza, which is a train wreck, literally, figuratively. One rail for almost like maybe 0.7 miles goes north when you run the red line. So if you want to run a train up to Vancouver, eventually off the 205, off the red line, you can't. You don't have any more capacity there. You can't add any more traffic. It'd be nice if they have a combined line where the green line and the red line merge into a different color, and it's its own rail line, so the people from Clackamas can take a direct line to the airport. You can't do that with the gateway the way that it's configured now. And so those are the places that you need to invest. Those are the things that are going to solve traffic jams. If you notice where the traffic jams start, they're usually always, always, always when the light rail ends. Across the Bridge of Vancouver, anything east, like anything, I should say, west of Portland, a lot of that is where the rail ends. And you do need to have modal split, and getting a better, more thorough train system would be doing that. And so hopefully no more freeways PDX will not just be about stopping a really crappy freeway expansion, but also going positive and then providing your way forward. I think personally, I think it's feasible if you do include rail access to Vancouver, and if you do increases in capacity for the MAX, that you can actually probably tear down the 5 freeway by the Rose Center and then use the 405 as the 5, rename it, and have one freeway going through town. I think it's completely feasible. There's a bunch of urban planning websites with professionals that go, yeah, the 5 can probably be torn down eventually. It happened on the other side of the river. Why not the east side of the river as well? In other news, Joey Gibson has a mugshot. He took off his hat. I call him Mike Love because he always has his hat on. And surprisingly, Mike Love of the Beach Boys, of course, always has the hat. He's surprisingly bald. There's no bald shaming here, but it's just like the hat's not helping. We all know what's underneath there. So he looks like he's gonna be finally brought under justice, perhaps, but maybe. But Oregon is still the same state that acquitted all those people from taking over the like bird sanctuary. They're like, are taking over a bird sanctuary with like heavy armory and militias. You know, and like whatever. And then like, you know, like what's so funny is like, you know, that is exactly white privilege right there. Is you can do an armed invasion of a bird sanctuary for God knows what reason, and then like everyone's like, it was okay. But if a person of color did it, holy moly, that's bad. That's yeah. So, that's also in the news as well. So the other, I usually try to stay off the clown car thing, but because like we were talking last week about like the Portland Grand Prix, which is coming up, and in racing there's something called silly season, and then that's where all the drivers switch seats and stuff. Like I think campaign season and should be just renamed to like dumb season. I'm not gonna play the audio because it's just like hokey, and like I decided it was just like meh. But basically Joe Biden released an ad saying healthcare is deeply personal to me. Deeply personal. It's just like, yeah, you know, like no crap, Sherlock. It's deeply personal for everyone. I'm facing a situation where I'm off Care Oregon because I make too much money and I need to continue my hormones, and I'm not sure how I'm going to do that. I can't pay for my company's insurance because that would go out of my paycheck, and I'm barely making it right now. So yeah, healthcare is deeply personal to everyone, not just because you lost a son to brain cancer. And everybody has losses, and to think that your loss is unique, I'm sorry, but at the same time, I've lost people in my life. I've lost people to texting and driving. I've lost people to cancer. And healthcare is personal for everyone. And to just say, oh, we can't change it. We have to just like incrementally improve what I did as vice president. It's just tone deaf. And I wouldn't be upset about it, but it's almost like 80% of Democrats are looking at say it's important to nominate a presidential candidate who supports Medicare for all. If there's a very funny and snarky write-up of this by one of my favorite writers, former Deadspin editor-in-chief, and as well as Special Projects, Tim Marchman, it appears in Vice. So there's that. We are taking your calls. The number is 503-231-8187. What do you think about the protest in general? It does feel like it's become a thing where I see alarming things online where you see people go, yeah, you know what? They're blocking the roadway. Let's hit them with cars. It just seems like it's open season on protesters in a lot of ways, and it is a fascist mindset. Like, my thing, I've got to go someplace right now, and you're blocking traffic, and I am important. And it's like, if you have more than five people get together for anything, it's a pretty serious deal. I mean, organizing right now is almost like herding cats. And so if you have more than 20 people that they all have common cause with each other and they're going to go out and demonstrate, it's a pretty serious grievance. And as I mentioned yesterday when I filled in for 10 minutes on the air, it feels like a lot of people are taking their duties as customers more so than their duties as citizens. And so in this environment, am I surprised that Sam Yehu in Texas is trying to make criminalized dissent? No, I'm not. Would I be surprised, and I didn't get to ask him this question, would I be surprised if the representative from Texas, McCall, would I be surprised if he's part of the like Ted Cruz's wing of right-wing Christianity? No. Dominionists, that would be completely unshocking. I'm not sure where we move on from here. It just feels like you're kind of nestled in a hole and you're not going anywhere. And the world is moving on. I was reading an article on CNBC about how China has built almost 19,000 miles worth of high-speed rail. And meanwhile, like, leaders of Cascadia are thinking, oh, yeah, you know, it might be a good idea to do a train, maybe. And then, like, I think Microsoft has pinched in some money for this as well. The idea is that, like, oh, we're going to alleviate traffic and give more people more places to live. But, yeah, it's rough because that's one of the things that, like, I am for the Cascadia high-speed rail. But there's a ghettoization that comes with that as well that I'm really worried about. And so whenever I read the ideas of rail going to Las Vegas, it's just like, yeah, that's going to basically make it so that you can continue the suburbs forever out in the Vegas desert. You're going to create like apartheid Los Angeles where all the poor people are living in the Vegas suburbs, take the train in. And then all the real estate in Los Angeles is going to skyrocket and you can't buy a house near where you actually live. It's almost a bailout to real estate interests in Vegas if they make a train that goes LA to Vegas. And how do you prevent that? How do you prevent speculative capitalism when you have something that's essential as like high-speed rail? That's a good question, and I don't think I have seen anybody, including myself, have an answer to that. It's one of those things where it's like one of those low reinforcers of society, and people don't actually stop and think, like when they're watching Home and Garden TV and then like Chuck and Skip Gaines are like redoing a house and they're like, oh, we bought this and then we're gonna flip this. They don't realize that that's somebody's house and you're making that house go up in value, and you don't know, maybe that person that bought the house at the cheaper price, maybe, and this might be going on a limb here, folks, maybe they actually want that wall between separating the kitchen from the living room. maybe that wall that you worked hard to knock out on, that was actually okay by somebody's standards. And it's just like that stuff is so internalized at this point. It just, no one stops to question it and say, hey, this is pretty messed up right here. And like the other fun thing in like cable world is like the junk pickers where like yahoos that don't like know that like eBay exists go like have all this like in like very rare things, like, oh, here's like an old like phone booth from 1940, there's like five of them left, and some guy, and then like the host that we're supposed to think is cool is like, I'll offer you $4,000 for it. And then like the guy's like, sure, and without even, not like, I don't even like it, of course it is a reality show, but I hope to God he knows the real value of that phone booth. And then like I think it's American Pickers or something, and it's just like I just can't believe we're this surface level where you don't think about the deeper things that are happening, and these shows are like popular, and it's just like, this is speculation. This is things that, this is like, this person has carried forth with this item throughout 30 years. They should be rewarded for it. They should have all the profit for it and not have to go through some Yahoo middleman that's just mugging for the camera. Look, I'm ripping off this yokel. Like, it's just, it's so bad. But then like, it's just like, it's not commented upon. It's absolutely nuts. If you have any quite last minute questions or anything, 203-231-8187. We're taking your phone calls. Last segment. Sometimes things don't plan out the way they go, and open segments like this happen. I'll be flat out honest with this. I thought the interview would go a little bit longer. 503-231-8187 is the number. Yeah, there's been earthquakes off the coast of Oregon. This morning, OPB reports that there's a 6.3 earthquake off the coast of Oregon. Which contributes to the earthquake activity that has been happening in the Pacific Northwest. Most of us know about this because of the signage that the city of Portland wants to put on buildings with unreinforced masonry. And so we have Ken on the line. Ken, what's up? You're on the Heather McCoy Show.
Heather, I like your show. Right now I'm feeling like you're using some divisive behavior with the calling people yahoos. I don't get... I understand, you know...
Well, but, I was...
If we want to have inclusiveness in this world, I think we're going to have to refrain from name-calling.
Well, I wasn't calling the person that was selling a yahoo. I was calling the person buying a yahoo. That's what he's saying when they go... I'll offer you $4,000 for this phone booth, and then when it's really worth, let's say, $10,000, and then they mug for the camera, and then they go, look, well, I'm taking advantage of this Yahoo. That's the full context of that.
Well, I mean, that's a simple thing that people do in life. I mean, we always try to make
money. But is it right?
It's relative, you know?
Okay.
I mean, I was at a yard sale, and I found a really nice guitar, and it was worth $1,000, but you know, that's
okay.
My luck. They didn't know. I mean, what am I supposed to say? Hey, you shouldn't sell that. Or I mean, it's human nature to take advantage. We live in a capitalist society.
That's my point. We have got a little bit of time left. Gordon, I believe, is on the next line.
I sure am, and I'll tell you, how many times can you fit the word "like" into a sentence?
Oh, I can do it like millions of times. That's awesome. So this is the end of the show. That was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it a lot. Thanks for joining us on the Heather McCoy Show. We're going to be right back next week. God knows what's going to happen. I'm just kind of booking these things week to week at this point. And so we'll see what happens. The music show is off. Join us next week for the Heather McCoy Show. The music show Smoke Signals from the Speakeasy has its week off, and it's going to join again next Saturday morning, 3 to 6 a.m. And I hope you like it. I hope you like it a lot. This is the Heather McCoy Show.
KBOO members, thank you for being a part of our amazing community. Please join us this year at Mike to the People, our annual election meeting. Do you want to help steer KBOO in a positive direction this fall? Plan on attending the annual election meeting, Mike to the People, September 14th from noon to 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater and make your voice heard. Cast your vote by 1 p.m. at the event and enjoy refreshments and live entertainment with local musicians West Coast Black Bear and Izzy BM. Hear a report back from your board of directors and get to know this year's candidates. Record your fondest memories of KBOO in a minute or less at the Mic to the People booth. This is an all ages and disability affirmative event. Again, that's the annual election meeting, Mic to the People, Saturday, September 14th from noon to 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, featuring West Coast Black Bear and Izzy BM. More information can be found at kboo.fm/meeting2019. Remember, your voice matters.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 11 o'clock. The time now is 11 o'clock. Coming up next, it's Between the Covers. David Damon welcomes Brendan Shimoda, an American of Japanese descent. He talks about his family being an enemy of the state during World War II in his book, The Grave on the Wall. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate, or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO proudly co-sponsors the Portland Folk Music Society concert series, featuring artists touring nationally and internationally. Shows start this September with Jim Queskin and Meredith Axelrod. The new season continues with artists Bill Staines, Radim Zenkel, and the Honey Whiskey Trio. Then 2020 kicks off with Kate Lee and Forrest O'Connor, followed by Sam Ryder and the Human Hands, Robin and Linda Williams, Pat Donahue, and Joni Harms. Portland Folk Music Society concerts are presented at the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steele Street in Portland. For more information, go to the website kboo.fm and click on Community Events.